Today we have the interesting subject of the engram. I want to talk to you about engrams, because although a great deal has been said about engrams, people still avoid them. They still avoid them with considerable thoroughness. And that's because they don't know what they are. An engram is a mental image picture containing pain and unconsciousness, and to a Dianeticist, that's all it contains. To a Scientologist, it also contains exteriorization. Everybody says, a mental image picture, so what? Well, what can this mental image picture do? What can it do? It can hold in existence an injury. That is its first and foremost activity that we're interested in. It can hold also in position by reason of the force of the injury thoughts, statements, actions, objects which existed at the time of the injury. It is, in essence, a 3D full reconstruction of an incident which contained in itself pain and unconsciousness. When you start thinking of pictures, you generally start thinking of art galleries. Well, we're not talking about art gallery pictures. The only reason we're saying mental image picture is because there is no other word that describes it adequately. But if you called it a mental image sculpturing, you would be better off because it has space in it. And when you think of pictures in this somewhat backward 20th century that is also modern, where all the power sources are used for war and all of the social reforms that they dream up are mostly to collect more taxes. You don't have pictures which demonstrate three-dimensional mass with adequacy. Now, an engram in full restimulation is exactly like being on the scene where the person is, and as a matter of fact, can be more real to the individual than his present time environment. Now, if you've been on this idea that a picture was simply a picture, and it was all cute, look around you right now and conceive of a picture of greater solidity, greater reality, and greater magnitude than this room, right where you are at this moment. All right, now conceive of a picture of this room, which is this room, but more real than this room. Are we sneaking up on that now? Now, to get even more specific, consider somebody, let us say, in an operating room, which is more real to him than the room he is in later. Now, that's an elsewhereness, you see. After this tremendous pain, unconsciousness, everything is elsewhere, maybe. This is a full engram in full restimulation, fully created. That is here. And 10 years or 1,000 years later, everything else is still elsewhere. You're talking to this fellow in elsewhere. His here is when he was hurt. And you complain about, as an auditor, as a Scientologist, you complain about the fact that he doesn't have much reality on his environment. And therefore, you say he is a low-reality case. Oh, no, this person has a reality. He's not a low-reality case. He's a low-present-time reality case. This is a big difference, you see. His present-time reality is low. But somewhere back in the stream of time, there is a reality which is more real than the reality he is walking around in. It's quite interesting for an auditor to bring somebody up to present time and have somebody arrive. Now, if you walked up, let's say you went to an insane asylum, and you walked down the corridor, and you said to every person you met in the corridor, come up to present time. That's all you said. Do you know that a percentage of the population of that insane asylum would turn sane? And a majority percentage of those who turn sane would remain sane. Now that's how easy it is. You're removing him from a real here into a less real here. Now his present time was an elsewhere. And his here-ness factor changed by the simple direction of an auditor to come to present time. This is too startling for people in mental healing to comprehend. It's much too startling. And it seems to you much too simple to do. But it is the major mechanic of what you are doing. Now, the subject today does not include how this engram got there, or how it goes away. We are simply taking up the isness of it. It is. Now, as long as we start walking off saying, well, we can erase these things, we can remove these things, we can change a person's position in time, we are to that degree avoiding looking at this thing. Now, you know that people like to have ARC breaks. They like to have their affinity, reality, and communication violated. You walk up somebody in the street, and you say, hello. And he says, well, you blankety blank blank, what is the idea of accosting me? What's the matter with him? Oh, we've got lots of explanations. We say, well, he has wife trouble, or he has husband trouble, or she does, or he says he's about to lose his job, or he's worried, or he's upset, or something. And that is the reason why he is so sharp with us. Oh, no, that's not the reason why. We can also ask, why does he have wife trouble? Why does she have husband trouble? It's real slippy. Second, we go into these whys. Why is he having so much difficulty in his livingness? Well, he uses his difficulty in a very interesting way. He gets enough problems and has enough ARC breaks in present time to keep his attention out of the engrams he is stuck in. Present time upset is the answer to sliding back down the track and being in that thing again. He's taking a rather interestingly forceful method of staying in present time. Why? Why does he take such a method? What is this thing? Well, he's trying to create enough here to make here more real than the here where he really is. Now, in view of the fact that a spirit, a Thetan, actually has the capability of creating a universe, we see that we are not dealing with little old decal pictures or crayon portraits. See, he can make something that is as solid to him as these walls are to you. And the engram in which he is currently stuck is that solid. And even though he can't see it, and you can't instantly find it, and even though this individual knows nothing about it, it's there. It's there. And whenever you see somebody with PT problems of magnitude, ARC breaks, so you can have one or two that just are, but when you can't fix them up, he's using them for another purpose. Now, you see, these things can't exist as themselves. Somebody walks up to you, and he says, "Boy, what grave did they dig you out of today?" And you say, "Come off of it." Or you say, "Into your hole, dog." And you feel a little cross with him. Now, that's just living. You get a cross reaction to somebody. Or you say, "Well, this person is upsetting." But if you're still thinking about it 10 or 15 minutes later, look out. If you're nursing it to your bosom, you've got a use for it. Therefore, when you try to clear up all of a person's present time problems, you may succeed only to discover sometime later that he doesn't like being without problems and has a brand new rash of them. Now, what's the explanation for this? He's just trying to exteriorize himself. He's just trying to pull out from the here-ness, which contains pain and unconsciousness, grave discomfort, danger, full perception, menace of any kind that you could describe. And he's trying to pull out of that and establish himself in a here-ness. And he will take the general tone of the engram and try to address it to present time so as to sort of run it out. He gets very involved and complicated at this stage. He tries to go through the full motions of an engram in order to discharge it. This we call dramatization, a highly technical term in Dianetics and Scientology. He is trying to run it out. He says, "Well, if I just obey its commands and go on through this way, one way or the other, why, eventually it'll disappear and discharge and it won't be there anymore, and then I will be all right." In other words, if I just keep running up and down the hall screaming, someday I won't be running up and down the hall screaming. This is perfectly true if he were doing it consciously, but he's not totally conscious about the mechanism, so it doesn't work. Now, there's some chap named after a sheep, I think, who has something called psychodrama. And he makes people go around through dramatizations of one character or another and just walk around doing horrible things or doing very aesthetic things or so on. But he has people moving around, doing something, and lets them more or less do what they seem to want to be able to do. Well, if this were directed, and if they knew what they were doing, and if he knew what he was doing, he would have 100% success. He would actually let people walk through the engram or engrams they were stuck in. He would let them walk through it, don't you see? And they'd come up on the sunny side. Actually, it's much simpler, however, just to tell them to come up to present time, and if they don't do that, find out what they can confront. It's just as silly as this, you see. I mean, our answers are so easy compared to the mystical, mystic answers, the fabulous religious answers, so on, that everybody knows that anything as vicious as an engram has to be handled with a great deal more ritual. It must be necessary to have more ritual if this thing has the bite I say it has. Obviously, we need signs of the cross, flaming swords. Obviously, why we have to draw designs and pentagons on the floor. You see, obviously. Anything but look. Now, the person who has tremendous ARC breaks, which continue forever, you know, he can't get rid of them. If you insult him, 18 years later, he is sitting there brooding. He never gets over this. This fellow is using a forceful method of exteriorization from an engram. Now, I don't mean he's trying to use the exteriorization part of it. He's trying to keep his attention so fixed on B that he won't look at A. Did you ever see anybody in, this is only one misemotional level of staying out of an engram, but did you ever see anybody who had had a bad blow or had received some bad news all of a sudden get very, very busy? And it's very, very busy. Well, it's the same mechanism. Same mechanism. And when they aren't very, very busy, why, they sit back and all of a sudden they feel terribly apathetic or they hurt or they're upset. And they just feel that if they could just get themselves by the nape of the neck and throw themselves into the arena of life and get very, very busy, they'd come out of it. And human beings are always telling human beings to do this. They're always saying, well, get interested in something or get interested in something else. And that would mean that their interest would cease in this thing which they continue to mock up. Every now and then, we have a tremendous recovery. We have a miracle recovery from one of these engrams. We'll look at that in a moment. But let's look first at the fact of the engram. Now, it isn't dreamed up. It happened. It really happened. An engram contains at least 53 different perceptics. Sight, sound, kinesthesia, joint orientation, smell, tactile. Someday, if you want to have a little fun, add up the various things that could be perceived in the physical universe. They're all there in an engram. You see, the thing is total. The thing is total. And it is an engram, and it hangs fire because a person has been overwhelmed. By an environment, and thereafter considers the environment a sort of god, and he keeps it mocked up. If you want to know what a man thinks God is, why, find out what he is keeping mocked up. He was in a battle, and first he was wounded, and then somebody in a counter charge ran over him with some cavalry horses, and he was still alive. And so somebody came along killing off the wounded, and they slit his throat, only they didn't make it. And he was still alive, survivor type, you see, something like that. And he's passing out and coming back too slightly, and then they throw him up on a pyramid of bodies that they're going to burn, and he gets burned, you know, something on that order. Well, of course, that's a death engram of some sort. Much beefier and much more common, by the way, than simple operations and all that. But it could be just an operation. Little boy sitting there in dentist chair, and he's having his teeth drilled out or his skull drilled out or whatever dentists do to amuse themselves. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why lots of people have an obsession with having operations. They think if they can just have enough operations or be chopped up enough or be given enough electric shocks or something like that, their attention actually will extrovert from this engram, and they'll have it done with, you see. They're just having enough happen in present time to keep their attention out of past. You see, past is here to them. All right? And they try to get operations and so on. You'll every once in a while run into somebody that is just obsessively getting himself chopped up or operated on. But anyhow, this little boy's sitting there. He's overcome. They give him some anesthesia of one kind or another. It's half operative. He three-quarters dies in the process, and he passes out, and he's very frightened. There's a big ARC break there in that they said, "Now, Johnny, this isn't going to hurt, you know. It hurt like hell," and so on. And you're liable to come along later as an auditor, 15, 20, doesn't matter how many years later, and these things don't age out. Time is the great charlatan. Time is the great charlatan. It is how thoroughly the individual was impressed by the pain, how thoroughly he was overwhelmed, how much violence he was faced with, and so on, that is the establisher of the time factor. And it just goes on from there. Now, you find him later on sitting in that dentist chair, smelling that anesthesia, feeling that drill, listening to the clatter of pans, going through the works. And maybe this fellow, every time he saw a girl with very, very black hair, he got a toothache, only he never noticed that it was the girl with the black hair that gave him a toothache, and that was the dentist's assistant, you see. And any factor in the engram that apparently shows up again simply serves to turn on the engram more forcefully. So these we call restimulators in the environment. And, of course, because girls with black hair always turn on this, then any time a girl with black hair shows up, then he gets a lock of such magnitude, it might also be an engram, and then any place where a girl with black hair has showed up, then the environment around her becomes restimulative, and we have what's known as an associative restimulator. It's just a restimulator which is restimulated by the basic restimulator, you see? So everything connected with girls with black hair begin to be things that haunt him. You get the idea, and this thing just goes on a widening parade. But here this individual is, and he has this engram in restimulation. It's all, if you could ever get him to look at any part of it, he would see that it was there in full 3D. Now, it isn't something that moves in on a magic slot and comes in from a standard bank computing machine. This we can forget about. That's an analogy, and if you carefully examine the books of Dianetics, it says it is an analogy. It doesn't say it's true, it just says it's an analogy. As a matter of fact, the guy is putting it there all the time on two or three vias. But it doesn't move in or turn on. His attention comes close to it, and it becomes stronger or brighter. It dims out and flares up. You see, without his seeing it very closely, or without paying attention to it, or even without knowing anything about it. So here this thing is, and it can turn on and it can turn off, but the way it turns on and turn off is simply to become, you might say, fed or starved with energy. You see, he accidentally feeds it some energy, or associative restimulator shows up, or restimulator shows up, and all of a sudden he says, well, boom, and he feeds this thing some more energy. It's hungry, it, you know, and it gets stronger and brighter, and the associative restimulator walks away, and he feels better, which is he merely feeds it less energy, This is quite interesting, what he's doing with this thing. But he could have 50 or 60 of these things piled on the original. And each one of these things would brighten up and flare down, you see. But every now and then we have a miracle recovery. The miracle recovery is just the fellow skids on the time track. That's all a miracle recovery is. He just slips. One day he's in a different moment of time than he was the day before, and all of a sudden he can see, or, you know, something like that. If his sight was shut off in the engram, either his eyesight is poor or he is blind, you see. Well, all right, let us say he moves off and all of a sudden changes the whole pattern of engram creation. Now he's going to mock up another engram or another type of engram. Something else has happened in the environment, not necessarily brutal. As a matter of fact, quite the contrary. Almost never does this happen under stress or brutality. It happens under hope or resurgence of one kind or another. If it does happen with the receipt of a new engram, you know, he always was asthmatic. And one day he was in an airplane crash and laid in the wreckage for 5 hours with broken ribs. You're liable to have him come out of the hospital after this and have no asthma at all for maybe 24 hours or 36 hours or a month or 2 months, and all of a sudden he's got asthma again. Get the idea? He had an engram that sort of overwhelmed the engram. It makes one wonder whether or not people don't go around picking up bad experiences worse than the experience they've had in order to overwhelm the thing that overwhelmed them. All right, here we have the miracle. Now, you can pull off the same miracle simply by changing his position on the time track. What is this thing called a time track? Time track is actually a Dianetic mechanism. It doesn't exist in fact, although you start talking to a person, it's so reasonable, and it so much approximates his thinking, this pattern, that he sort of, he'll occasionally say time track somebody, and he'll mock something up, and it'll look like a railroad track with engrams and incidents at each gradient point of it, and that sort of thing. That's quite all right. The time track actually is a record of each consecutive moment of time in picture form that the individual recreates when restimulated. That's a reactive time track. You have an analytical time track. An individual can do this so well that you can send him to the 3rd of January, 1947, and have him run from 8 o'clock in the morning until 12 noon, repetitively, over and over and over and over. He will finally recreate that whole four-hour span. He will reread his mail, call off the names and addresses of all of the people, give all of his appointments for that day. See, just do everything that he did there, and if you kept it up and kept it up and kept developing this thing, you could develop it up to the total reality of the environment of the 3rd of January, 1947. Not just a surface look. I mean, he could develop it totally. So if he was in his office that morning, he'd have that office that he had in 1947 all over again. Quite amusing if you realize the capabilities of memory and other capabilities which the individual has. Now, a Dianetic auditor can return a person to. That's not saying it's the same as remember. Remember and return are two different things. Returning is simply seeing, not remembering. You didn't have to have any memory of the thing at all to return to something. And as long as you say, you'll hear this odd non sequitur. An individual is told by you that you ran somebody through birth, the birth engram or something. And he'll say, that's silly. This is total non sequitur. Nobody can remember birth. That's nothing to do with what you just said, you see. You didn't say you got him to remember birth. You said he ran him through it. See, birth is. The birth engram is capable of being reconstructed totally as a picture and re-experienced by the individual who, in present time, has no recollection of it at all. But re-experiencing it as a picture will get all of his memories, which were thought and recalled at this moment, you see? You see, it's not memory. It's just bringing this whole nomenclature up to date. memory is being in PT or something approximating it and recalling that something is in the past. Well, now, returning and running an engram doesn't follow these requisites at all. A person is in the past going through it as though it were PT. And you simply revitalize the here-ness factor in order to accustom himself again to that here-ness, which is not a true here-ness, you see, so that he can then go to what has been to him an elsewhere-ness, but what the rest of us consider here. Now, if you get the here's and there's all disentangled, you got it made. Would you let him consciously and knowingly go through this whole thing again? You let him redevelop the whole thing again. You let him re-experience it. In other words, you give him a great deal of experience in confronting it. And he hasn't confronted it, even though he has it totally mocked up, although it's totally created. Although this mental image picture called the engram is so solid that he is sure he could wrap his knuckles against the walls of its rooms and make a large popping sound. And possibly when he got to look at it, he would find that it was just as solid to him or more solid than any PT that you can give him. He doesn't look at it. He doesn't confront it. Now, creating something is not confronting it. These are two different things. You can get something created that you don't confront. Go down to a knitting store and ask them to knit you a sweater, and then call them up a month later and tell them you've canceled the order. You've been instrumental in creating something which you never saw, right? Well, similarly, an individual can create an engram which he never sees. He's got to look at it before he's through with it. And there is no short road out. Ptolemy was once told by Pythagoras, I think, that there was no royal road to geometry. And Pythagoras said, you're asking me to teach you geometry in the morning. And Ptolemy said, well, of course, after all, I'm king, and I should be able to get this sort of thing. And Pythagoras said, well, under no circumstances is there a royal road to geometry, and there's certainly no royal road to an engram. Now, whether or not it was Pythagoras or Ptolemy or told about Cleopatra is beside the point. The whole point here, totally, is that there isn't any magic button that will confront an engram for the preclear. Boy, once that soaks in, these magic button figure boys fold up. They keep searching for a button. They could just think a certain thought, it'd all go boom. If they could just think a certain thought, it'd all be all right. Well, I've had 28 years of experience in looking this thing over, and the first time I noticed that there was something called a mind and noticed that nobody knew anything about it. And I've seen an awful lot of buttons. I've seen an awful lot of people looking over buttons, and I've seen a lot of people trying to figure their way through this thing. And the final analysis, the horrible part of it is there is no way to live except to live. And there's no way to confront an engram except look at it. This is discouraging, isn't it? You can't hire somebody else to look at it for you. But you'd swear to Pete that some people who get you to audit them are doing just that. All they've got to do is sit back with a total irresponsibility and let you do all the confronting this. And if you confront it all perfectly, they'll be well. Funny part of it is, old Dianetic auditors could actually do this to some degree. What they were really doing was keying the individual out of one set into something else or some easier portion of the time track. But the funny part of it is, the fellow who was doing the confronting all along the line was doing the confronting, even if he thought the auditor was doing it. You could do this weird thing in Dianetics way back when, and you can do this weird thing with it today. You can take somebody and make him totally well without his ever waking up to anything that was going on. You got him to look a little bit, and that little bit of looking got him well, and he never even realized he was well. It's quite interesting. Funny part of it is, he probably never realized what he was sick of. Now, that is the main thing that depresses us. In fact, chap walks in and he's on crutches. You say, what's wrong? He says, I have asthma. Don't challenge him. Don't even ask him, well, yeah, you got asthma. What's wrong with your legs? No, do that after you've audited him for a while. You say, what goes with the legs, or something friendly? Legs, the legs. Oh, well, they're all right. That's nothing you can do about that. Chest, though, chest much better. You finally get him upstairs after a while to a point where he comes into an auditing session one day and he says, you know, there's something wrong with my legs. No. Now, that's on a highly visible level. And it's amusing simply because it is on a visible level. The auditor always knows much better what's wrong with the PC than the PC does. That's no license to tell the preclair. The auditor usually can spot what engram the PC is in before the PC can spot it. The trick is, the auditor isn't in that engram. See, the auditor isn't in the engram, so he can, by various vias, discussion and so forth, he can take a look at it. He can use an E-meter. An E-meter is a good-looking machine. You can look at engrams with an E-meter and look at the time track and do all sorts of weird things with an E-meter. The auditor doesn't mind confronting this thing. He's not in it. But the PC is in it and is the last one to confront it. It's just like the fellow who was the last one in the organization to hear about some important occurrence in the organization. They tell the janitor, and they tell the reception, and they tell some of the outside business firms, and it's talked about in the typing pool, and it's discussed elsewhere. And then somebody's wife, that he meets at a dinner party, the somebody, not even being connected with the organization, tells the president. And he hears about it, finally. Warehouse 62 has just burned down. But he hears it at a dinner party from somebody whose wife, who isn't even connected with the organization, he hears it from the person's wife, not even that person. You got it? Now, there's your idea, the last man to know. The last man to know is always the PC. You walking around see this PC dramatizing an incident. Every time he goes out to a flying field, he throws himself on his face. He goes out, he's going to leave at the airport, and he's going to fly someplace, and he walks out the gate, and the first thing he does is throw himself on the runway, you know. Looks around, then briskly runs to the plane. Well, funny part of it is, he doesn't really go that far. Social responses restrain him from totally dramatizing what he should do at that instant. Truth of the matter is, in the war, he was on his way to a dugout, and the machine gun bullets hit him and threw him down. So he now knows what to do when near airplanes. You lie down. The idea is very educational. Now, social responses keep him from lying down as he's supposed to. So he stands up, but the second he gets out on the runway, you'll notice he'll shorten in stature. You see, shortens a little bit in stature, and then scurries like mad and is totally out of communication right up to the moment he gets in the airplane. He gets in his seat, and he sits down, and he looks like a man just retrieved from death, you know. Being in an airplane had nothing to do with the engram. Now, anybody traveling with him a great deal would know he was scared as hell of airfields. And possibly knowing something of his past history could tell him why. Well, that's because the fellow was wounded on an airfield. That's simple. But do you know this fellow may give you a social response of having that information, but actually doesn't know it? If he knew it, he'd confront it and he'd no longer do it. He says, yes, well, Eve, I've always been nervous about airfields, you know. I saw a movie once. and so forth. And my brother, you know, was in the war, and he was a pilot, and he crashed. And airfields have always made me nervous ever since my brother crashed. Well, boy, that's awful close to knowing about it. Usually they just go out in an airfield, feel sick, shorten in stature, try to pull their heads inside their collar, scurry up to the airplane, get in it somehow, and sit there and gasp. Everybody else notices this. They're so involved in bracing themselves up to actually making this, that seems to be a usual thing. Doesn't everybody feel this way on an airfield? I get to be a member of parliament, and somebody says, let's put some proper airfields. A member of Congress would say, let's let out some contracts that I can get a cut of. Slight different phrasing, practically the same thing. And this member or senator would, however, say, no. No. They give you 18,652 statistical reasons, all beautifully backed up, why you should build no more airfields. And somebody else comes along and says, this is irrational, and this is the last thing he'll stand for. Now he will prove to them and to you all over again how this couldn't possibly be the case. You could go right back to the hospital records, find out the man was halfway to a foxhole on an airfield and was shot down and pinned to the ground by enemy machine gun bullets. He won't look at that. Get the idea? I'm afraid a great deal of government is done by a great many engrams. That's why you mustn't evaluate for the PC. You've got to let him find out on a gradient scale which is tolerable to him. It becomes very physically painful to a preclear to have you tell him what's wrong with him. Because you're forcing him, without doing a good auditing job, to confront something he cannot confront. Now, you can invite his attention. You can solicit and enlist his interest in confronting something. You see, he has a bad leg. You can get him off on the subject of shoelaces. But even that might be too near. You can let him in on it. Gradually, carefully, and with good ARC. But you've got to let him find out. Don't walk up to a person and say, you got bad breath, you know. He won't do anything about it. He just feel kind of bad. He won't think or act. He'll just feel bad. What do you mean, feel bad? He'll hurt. Well, he's probably got some blow in the mouth. There's probably some physical contusion involved in this. He's been struck in a fight, or he's had something happen dental-wise or something. He can't communicate with this particular area, which is the same thing as saying he can't confront it. Now, you can't make him confront anything like that directly. You suddenly cave him in, you make him feel bad. In other words, you stimulate the engram of the incident. You make his mouth hurt. Well, you don't make men think by hurting them. I assure you of this. It's not a humanitarian fact. It is simply a fact. That's all. It's just a fact. You cannot make men think by hurting them. You can make them react by hurting them. You can make them misthink by hurting them. But the oddity of associative reason, which they get out of being hurt, is a pattern which would be very interesting to inspect someday. Somebody comes along and kicks a dog. What is his chain of thought from that kick on? It'll probably wind up with, I'm supposed to be here. Beware where he's kicked. Where he was kicked was a greater here-ness than PT, than present time, you see? So if you kick a dog enough who is lying in a certain doorway, you might wind up with always having the dog in that doorway, which is not your intention at all. Your intention is to get the dog out of the doorway. And Pavlov would have done it differently. He would have put a bowl of doggo biscotto or something outside the doorway, and the dog would run over to that and be rewarded for being out of the doorway. And Pavlov would have had it all tied up, except your dog and my dog don't like doggo biscotto, you see. I mean, the whole psychological pattern would fall down on this non sequitur point. Never occurs to anybody to say to the dog, "Here, look here, old chap, why don't you move yourself over there? Why don't you lie over there out of the road and you won't get stepped on?" Show him place to lie down over there. Give him a pat on the head. And don't even have to give him a pat on the head, by the way. Dogs don't work for rewards, particularly. The best working dogs aren't rewarded at all. They're communicated with. They're permitted to contribute. It doesn't occur to this Pavlovian school of thought that things contribute and things are contributed to, and that if you don't permit something to contribute, it won't work. That's totally outside of their rationale. They are the ones who hand out the punishment. They are the ones who hand out the rewards, you know. The contribution is covert and unseen. It's very funny. You sometimes say to a dog, "See here, old chap, how about knocking off this snarling at the postman, hmm? Not a bad fellow. Brings the mail, you know." I even showed a dog a check one time that came regularly in the mail, and I said, "This is what you're barking at, you fool." He looked very ashamed. Took to biting the policeman, or the mailman, after that. Well, anyhow, Pavlov is so wrong that this particular dog was one of the smartest dogs I ever had. He was a beautiful, beautiful police dog. Shepherd. And he didn't like the butcher. Obviously, Pavlov would have said the fellow was nuts. Dog was nuts. He didn't like the butcher. He didn't either. The butcher was a friend of the family. The butcher was a perfectly fine fellow. But the dog didn't like the butcher. The butcher was always coming around trying to bribe him. Butcher was trying to buy his friendship. Big ARC break. Dog wasn't about to have his friendship bought. If anybody wanted to be a friend to him, they had to stand on their own 2 feet like any other dog. He was getting absolutely savage on the subject of butchers. This particular butcher. He liked other butchers. No, whenever there is an impact, wherever there is a solid pressure against, whenever there is an overwhelmingness of the individual, whenever there is duress, particularly to containing great pain and unconsciousness and flying out of the head, that sort of thing, when there are these things, you tend to get a greater here-ness than a now here-ness. this present time here-ness that we experience consecutively is no longer experienced with any great degree by the individual. He's also experiencing another here-ness. And this other here-ness is an engram. Now, he's not only just experiencing one other here-ness, he may be experiencing several, at which moment he is confused. And he'll be first in one and then another. He is the victim of experience. This is the way he adds it up. Now, there are many mechanisms how he permits himself to become the victim of experience to this degree, but as I say, we're not interested in the whys right now. We're just interested in the fact. Individuals who are given automobile accidents have automobile accidents. Dogs that are kicked out of the way get in the way. See how silly all this is. Criminals who are put in jail for stealing steal. This is just the way it is. But you add in some additional vagaries about how they get back in the road again, and how they now steal, and how they now have accidents that nobody could predict. And these engrams are the mental image pictures containing pain, unconsciousness, 53 different perceptions, which make a more real environment to the individual than any other environment he knows anything about, including the auditing room in which he is receiving Scientology auditing. And being in this state of affairs, the only way he can keep himself yanked up to present time, grabbed up to present time, spread out in present time, the only way he can keep his attention in present time, and the only way he can keep the hole in his chest turned off or the missing side of his skull out of sight is to have problems, to have ARC breaks, to have difficulties with his environment, to get involved in the environment in some outlandish fashion. So he makes something to be trapped in and then makes something to untrap himself, and both of them are equally no answer to anything. The criminal who is put in jail for stealing then and thereafter can be expected to steal. The individual who has been hurt and who has and receives and makes and continues an engram can be expected to receive, make, have, and continue engrams. This is something Homo sap does. Now, to place everything at the gate and door of an engram and to say that an engram is basically everything there is wrong with the individual is to exclude one little other portion of the universe of the mind. And that little other portion here is thought, ideas, considerations, and other subheadings under thought. An individual not only has thoughts in an engram, he can think about them. And he has certain thoughts and ideas which lead him up to this creation. He has made certain bargains and agreements and considerations, all on a thought level, which go behind and which author one of these engrams. The picture of an engram is not hopeless. It is so far from hopeless that you, with auditing skill, could resolve any engram there is. But we're not talking about what you can do with one. We're not talking about how it gets there. We're not talking about how it goes away. We're just talking about the fact of one. And don't ever let me catch you doing this as an auditor, thinking so hard about how to get rid of one that you forget there is one. You understand that? Basically, the thing is, when we get into the very brief coverage we give to the physical universe here, that's the keynote. Whoever made it, however it got here, for God's sakes, recognize one thing about it. It is. Scientologist does not make the blunder. And if he does, he'll quickly amend it and come around the other way of saying all is unreal. Everything is the product of the mind and thought, and therefore it isn't. Boy, I would like somebody to tell me how those thoughts can be joined together with any grace with what rhinoceros ballet dancing these thoughts would be tied up. The thing is a product of the mind and the spirit, so it isn't. That's something like saying, the Jaguar factory builds Jaguars, so there is no Jaguar factory, so there are no Jaguars. Jaguars are all imaginary. Jaguars are all imaginary because they're the product of a design board. Therefore, if you're driving down the street in a Jaguar, it might disappear at any moment because the thing is a product of thought. That's a pretty silly statement, isn't it? And yet that's the statement made by some religionists when they say it's everything is conceived by the mind, therefore it isn't. Therefore, there's no such thing as matter. Well, every engram there is conceived by the mind. That's for sure. But that's no reason they aren't. They are. They do exist. And the one thing you must know about them is they are. No further significance. They just are. How they got there, what they copy, and so forth, is an interesting study. But it's a study that can be embarked upon only if we understand that these things are. And when you run into them in preclears, and when you handle them in cases, when you see them registering on e-meters, don't get so busy thinking about how to get the person out of them that you forget what you're trying to get them out of. The basic recognition on the part of a preclear for the escapement of an engram is that it is. And this is accomplished simply by his confronting it. And when he can confront it, it's confronted. And it isn't. And the only road out is the road through. And the first step in handling any engram or any mental image picture is a necessity on the part of the auditor to lay aside all other significances than one as his basic stepping stone, and then to proceed forward from that one. And that first one is, regardless of how it got there, regardless of how he's going to handle it, the engram, the mental image picture, is. And proceeding from that point, you've whipped the world of the mind. This is whipped from there on. Any trouble you have with a preclear is because you proceeded from the point of it isn't. And you're trying to make an isn'tness a wasn'tness, and you'll never do it. Thank you.